Go ahead and take a seat. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Now, speaking only for myself, it's been over 2 years since I've had a live Court of Appeals hearing versus our Zoom platform, so I'm absolutely tickled to death and wasn't real sure how we come in the morning to begin our action. Anyway, we do have a calendar today with three oral cases to be presented today, April 20th, 2022. The marshal has identified the panel. I'm going to ask that she call the first case for consideration.
Calling case number A21-1441, Munger v. State of Minnesota.
And to each of the attorneys, of course, you've been here before. If you can remember the process here in the actual judicial center, that means that appellate counsel, when you're ready to proceed, you can approach the podium.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Devi Axelson. I represent the appellant Dinesh Munger. Mr. Munger's guilty plea to third-degree criminal sexual conduct of a mentally incapacitated complainant was invalid because Mr. Munger did not admit that MMG knowingly ingested alcohol. The district court attempted to salvage Mr. Munger's conviction by pleading him guilty to a different offense that was not considered as part of the specific terms of his plea agreement.
I just want to clarify, when I read the petition below, it was just to vacate the conviction. There is no request to withdraw a plea. And so I just want to make clear in my own mind what it is you're requesting. Are you requesting that we vacate the conviction or that your client can withdraw his plea? What is it you're asking us to do?
We are not asking to vacate the conviction. I think that the remedy is that his plea would be withdrawn because the plea that the judge entered on his behalf is for an offense he didn't admit to that violates his plea agreement, and that the case would start over. The state would have the opportunity to go back to square one, impose the initial complaint that they filed, and nobody would be bound by the agreement that's been breached here.
I just wanted to make clear because of what was requested below.
For sure, yes.
So I'm going to comprehend that as being, if we agree with you, Mr. Axelson, that in fact the plea can be withdrawn, that we need to do something mechanically in order to vacate the plea that's presently of record?
Yes, I think that what this court would find is that the plea has been breached, that his plea to a mentally incapacitated complainant was breached when it was altered and changed to a physically helpless complainant. And because the terms of the guilty plea were breached, that we would start back at square one and that the plea would be withdrawn. And the reason that the plea was breached here is because although the original complaint just listed subdivision 1D, which lists three different potential offenses, once we got to the plea petition that was entered, the plea petition specifically only listed one of the potential ways to commit a 1D offense, and that was for a mental incapacitated complainant.
Okay, so I'm wondering why that makes a difference. I'm looking at the plea petition, which says he wishes to enter a plea of guilty to the offense of violating 609.344 1D. Which, as we know, has three different alternative ways of committing that offense. But the plea, as I read it, was to the criminal sexual conduct in the third degree offense. And I think the real argument you're making is that the plea is not accurate because, in fact, the factual basis that was laid for the plea doesn't work anymore based on the Khalil decision. Am I right about what your argument is?
Well, I guess I don't agree that he was pleading guilty to the third degree in general. I think that the specific terms of the plea agreement means that even though there are three alternative ways to violate 1D, the parties, once you reach a plea agreement, it becomes a contract, and the contract was specific to a mentally incapacitated complainant. I agree that Khalil makes the factual basis insufficient.
Well, where does the plea agreement say that was solely the basis under 1D that he was entering the plea to mental impairment?
Under paragraph 4 on the first page of the petition, enter a plea of guilty, it specifically say the actor knows or has reason to know that the complainant is, and then it only says mental incapacitation. If it was also covering physical helplessness, that would have been listed in that paragraph. And we also know that when the judge mentioned the potential of physical helplessness, the defense attorney jumped in and said that the only thing that we're considering here is the mental incapacitation based on intoxication. The state would have had an opportunity at that point to say, no, our complaint made this more broad. We were talking about both potential offenses. They could have asked to lay a factual basis for that additional offense, but they didn't do so. And plea agreements are different than the sufficiency cases that the state relies on, and then in the fact that they're contracts, and contracts are treated differently than trials. And so when you have a contract and a person specifically agrees to specific terms of a contract, if there's a change in that contract, it's a breach.
And so again, it gets back to my question. What did he plead to? Because I'm looking at paragraph 28 of the plea petition, and it just says, I've agreed to enter a plea of guilty to, you know, committing the offense in violation of 609.3441D, which again does not reference the which of the three alternatives. And I note also on the record at the plea hearing, he entered a plea of guilty to violating the statute without going further to articulate whether it was based on mental impairment, mental incapacity, or physical helplessness. So I think that, you know, and this was a plea agreement that involved dismissal of more serious charges. So, I mean, there was more to this plea agreement than the factual basis set forth in support of it. So I'm trying to understand your breach of contract argument when it seems to me your argument is that there was not the proper factual basis for the plea as entered.
Well, I agree that there are some parts of the plea petition. There's a paragraph you specifically mentioned that listed it more generally. But under 4, it's pretty clear that it's mental incapacitation. If you look on page 4 of the plea agreement
discussion.
Okay,
4 aside, would you agree that there was a sufficient basis for a factual plea to physical helplessness based on his statement that she was falling down drunk?
No, I don't agree with that. And I specifically argue in my brief that there isn't a factual basis to establish
incapacitation.
Physical helplessness. What's that?
How about incapacitation?
Well, there would have been under the old version of it, mental incapacitation based on the, but Khalil changes that. But on the specific
so
terms.
So what exactly did his statement as far as she was falling down drunk, what would that have proven?
That she wasn't able to give reasoned consent. And reasoned consent is a lower standard than unconsciousness or not able to give consent at all. And as I explained in my brief, being intoxicated, people don't reason as well as they would. And that was part of the reason, I'm guessing, that the legislature created that portion of this of 1D is for mental incapacitation would be for failure to give reasoned consent. And a person
so under 609, well, under the I won't need to recite the statute. Under 1D, so mental impairment, mental incapacitation, or physically helpless, you're saying that this is not a distinction without meaning, that we're going to carve out each one and have to determine what the specificity of the plea is.
Yes, and they each have different jury instructions. They have different definitions. And a person who's pleading guilty, he may not have been willing to admit that, and there's a difference between admitting that somebody was so drunk that they didn't give reasoned consent. It's a worse thing to admit that somebody is blackout drunk and they're unconscious altogether. And so when somebody
is falling
down drunk would be failure to give reasoned consent. Passed out drunk is another level of being incoherent, and that's.
But doesn't
it,
Barrios? Didn't we actually lump the falling down drunk in extreme intoxication into a saying that those facts support? I think that was a jury verdict of someone who was physically helpless.
Well, I would say that the cases that I all read, including Barrios, usually talk about at some point being unconscious, and there's no admission here of unconsciousness. The rule case that the state relied on to, again, has unconsciousness as part of it. And I think Barrios, there might have been going in and out of an unconsciousness, but we don't have that here based on the admissions made on the record.
And again, this is a plea agreement case.
Yes.
So you're not going to have the full evidentiary record that you would following a trial where you have a victim testifying or others testifying about their observations. So it seems like it's an apples and oranges to say, well, if he didn't admit to all these facts that we've seen on sufficiency challenges to be sufficient or insufficient, then it doesn't work here. I mean, here we have somebody who wanted to plead guilty to the offense of crim sex in the third degree, which can be committed in a very, you know, in these alternative ways. He testified that she was very intoxicated, right, that she did lack the ability to give reasoned consent, but also testified that his statements to investigators that she was falling down drunk were accurate.
Yep.
And I'm just wondering, why isn't that enough in the context of a plea agreement to say, you know what, it's sufficient?
Well, we will never get to that step because the state loses on all the steps before that, including the fact that if you look at Detman, there was no knowing and intelligent and voluntary discussion of this additional offense.
It's not an additional offense. That's the point, the trouble I'm having with your argument. It's not an additional or different offense. The offense is something that can be committed in three different ways. For purposes of his decision to enter a guilty plea, what difference does it make whether the factual basis supports one of the three alternatives versus the other?
Well, it only supports one. It only supports mental incapacitation. There is not a factual basis to support physical helplessness. And when you say that, we're not looking at a full trial where everybody's testified, the problem here is nobody is considering physical helplessness when he's entering his plea. They're not asking him if at some point she was unconscious or going in and out of consciousness, which would support a physical helplessness version of this statute. So the different versions of 1D have different components, different elements, and the physical helplessness is...
Doesn't State v. Watson, which is relied on by the state, indicate that someone who is severely intoxicated would be physically helpless? I don't mean to catch a cold if you're not familiar with those.
Yeah, I don't specifically remember that. I think if you look at the specific terms of the definition of physical helplessness, what he admits to here falls short of that. The farthest he goes is falling down drunk. He does not say in and out of consciousness. He does not say so drunk that she's unable to
I thought he said
consent.
In and out of consciousness.
No, he does not say that? So the judge made a finding on that. It's not supported by his actual statements. The most damaging statement I would say that he makes is that she was falling down drunk. But again, that falls far short of what's required for physical helplessness. It doesn't establish that she's asleep or unconscious. It doesn't establish that she's unable to withhold consent or withdraw consent because of a physical condition. He never admitted that she was so drunk she was unable to give consent at all. And then the third one is unable to communicate non-consent and the condition is known or reasonably or should have been known to the actor. He admitted that she was drunk, but not so drunk she was unable to communicate non-consent.
So
and
Mr.
him also
Axelson,
being drunk. Yes, go ahead.
So you are arguing that the plea was inaccurate, the factual basis for the plea was inaccurate.
Well, the first argument and the strongest argument is this violates the specific terms of his plea agreement. You can't get somebody to plead guilty to mental incapacitation and then, because that's no longer valid based on a Supreme Court opinion, change the offense that he plead guilty to. So that's a violation of the plea agreement. The second...
So one of the reasons that we don't want people to plead guilty unless it's an accurate knowing and voluntary plea is so that they don't plead guilty to a crime that's more serious than what they are actually admitting to.
Yes.
And here, to Judge Bjorkman's point, he pled guilty to crim sex 3. He was convicted of crim sex 3. It wasn't a crime that was more serious than the one that he pled guilty to.
Well, I would agree they have the same sentence, and they're also in the same subdivision. But I think if you argued to somebody on the street, what is more serious, having sex with somebody who's too drunk to give reasoned consent or having sex with somebody who's passed out completely, the second one would be considered the more serious offense.
But it doesn't really matter because the legislature has said that they're the same.
That's correct. But you have to look at, do you knowingly, voluntarily, intelligently look at what happened here and think he was admitting to a different version of 1D. And
we don't have that. Which you're basing your argument on, part of the issue there was that it was a jury verdict. And if you take away she drank alcohol to intoxication herself, it wasn't administered to her,
then you don't know if the jury found her guilty on one of, or found him guilty on one of the other two prongs.
Yeah.
And here, the judge, we know how the judge was thinking because the judge said falling down drunk.
So we do know that, but that's also, you know, Detman says you can't just look at statements that were made as part of the factual basis unless the defendant knew that those statements were being used to create the elements of an offense. So Detman says that you can't do what the district court judge did here either. And we, again, run into the same problem that this isn't what is bargained for. You couldn't say that a contract is valid because you're going to get the same amount of profit from the contract, but we changed toothbrushes to toothpaste as part of the contract. Again, that would be a breach of the toothpaste and toothbrushes are very similar, but that would be a breach of the specific terms of the contract, even if the profits remain the same. And so even if the punishment remains the same, the actual thing that he's admitting to is breached here, and that's the problem. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Hersey?
May it please the court, counsel, my name is Scott Hersey, and I'm a special assistant Mahnomen County attorney appearing on behalf of the respondent, the state of Minnesota. In this case, the appellant admitted during his guilty plea that the victim was falling down drunk, and he acknowledged that she was so intoxicated that she lacked the judgment to give reason to consent. And I submit to the court that that is sufficient to constitute being physically helpless. And there are a number of cases from this court and the Supreme Court that say being falling down drunk and in similar situations, even though a person is still conscious, is sufficient for being physically helpless and meeting that definition.
Well, what's your strongest case you have in support of that proposition? Because counsel has made a very strong argument that the record here just doesn't support physical helplessness as defined by the statute and the case law. What's your strongest support?
I understand that, and I respectfully disagree with counsel. And some of the cases that the district court relied on were Barrios, Perkins, and Taylor. I myself would rely on Owen because I'm more familiar with that case. It was a case I handled previously, and that was one where the victim, and I cited that in my brief, the victim was walking, but she felt very heavy. She was extremely lightheaded. She had trouble talking. She did pass out at one point, but she was awake at other points. And so I respectfully disagree with counsel that he equates physical helplessness with unconsciousness, because that's not what the case law from this court or from the Minnesota Supreme Court has said. If someone is falling down drunk, the case law is they are physically helpless.
And are the cases you rely on plea cases or verdict, jury verdict cases?
The ones I'm referring to, and especially Owen, Judge, they are verdicts, but one of the members of this panel made the good point that when they come out of a jury trial, you will have every detail scrutinized through direct examination and cross-examination, and so you get a very, very complete record of every single indicia of intoxication of that victim. But that's not what you see when you have a guilty plea. And here, you at least have the defendant saying she was falling down drunk, she couldn't even walk, and he fully agreed with the court that she lacked the judgment to give reasoned consent. And I would submit that those under the case law do, in fact, constitute physically helpless. And again, I would submit that Khalil is in opposite to our particular situation here. As stated, the reason the Supreme Court reversed in that case was because the district court gave an erroneous jury instruction on mental incapacity. And the Supreme Court could not tell if the jury relied on that erroneous instruction or relied on physically helpless. So it couldn't say that the instruction was harmless. So the Supreme Court did reverse.
How do you respond, counsel, to the argument that setting aside the accuracy of the plea, that it breaches the plea agreement itself to not let Mr. Mongar withdraw his plea at this point?
I would say to that judge that he pled guilty to criminal sexual conduct in the third degree under Minnesota Statute 609-344, Subdivision 1D. He said he went over the complaint with his attorney, and the complaint clearly charged all three alternatives. It clearly charged under that statute, and it specifically charged criminal sexual conduct in the third degree. And not only that, but it alleged both grounds, physical helplessness and mental incapacity in the probable cause portion. So he was fully aware of what he was pleading to.
Well, he indicated in the plea petition, I'm pleading guilty, or I've been charged with Crim Sex 3. D, actor knows or has reason to know that the complainant is mentally incapacitated. And so that's what the plea petition says. And you'd agree with me that the discussion on the record in terms of trying to get the factual basis for this plea focused exclusively on the mental incapacity alternative under 1D.
That is true, but I would also point out that but for the involuntary administration of the substance, those two definitions of mental incapacity and physically helpless under these facts are the same. This factual basis satisfies both of those, except for the involuntary administration. He indicated that he was pleading guilty. He understood the charges. He was pleading guilty to the charge of engaging in sexual penetration with the victim who was so intoxicated she did not have the capacity to consent, and she was falling down drunk. And that is one of the alternatives. And My concern is that if we adopt counsel's position, we're transferring the entire body of contract law into criminal law. And as I read the cases, there are analogies to contract law in certain circumstances, but that is tempered depending on the circumstances. And in this particular case, just an analogy to contract law, I don't think really answers the question. Was he misled at all? He was not misled. He gave the factual basis to one of the alternatives of third-degree criminal sexual conduct, and that is what he was sentenced for.
But Mr. Axelson says that by changing the prong under which he pled guilty to from mentally incapacitated to physically helpless, that undermines the intelligence part of his plea agreement.
But I would suggest that he knew he was pleading guilty to sexual intercourse with a drunken victim who lacked the capacity to consent. And it doesn't matter whether it falls on any one of those particular prongs. And I would rely on the decision in State versus Ruel, where the court instructed a jury on physical helplessness when the original charge was under mental incapacity, which is similar to this. But this court upheld that conviction and said either alternative may frequently involve consideration of the same evidence. And so I would suggest the rule is applicable here even in a guilty plea situation. If we adopt counsel's position, I think we're putting a higher appellate standard to guilty pleas, which routinely have less of a factual basis than jury trials, upholding jury trials. We give significant deference to juries. I think we should give significant deference to district court judges and post-conviction judges, particularly when we're talking about the same judge issuing the post-conviction order that took the original plea.
Do you agree that the district court erred when it made a reference to the complainant slash victim here coming in and out of consciousness?
Yes. Mr. Axelson is correct there. I don't know where that came from, but I looked through the record. I could not find that in the record. That is correct. I would further rely on State versus Begbie, which held that unanimity of a verdict is not required for alternative means of committing a crime. And I would argue that, therefore, the district court can determine a guilty plea which has alternative means of committing a crime if the factual basis supports it. And I would submit that is what the district court did here. It would have been preferable and would have given a cleaner record if the district court had simply indicated, by the way, I'm accepting your plea on this particular prong, but it's still the same statute, it's the same crime, it's the same severity level. and that would have been preferable for the record. Unfortunately, that didn't happen, but the district court clarified that issue when it made its post-conviction order. And I would submit that the plea was intelligently made, because the case law says that means a person has to understand the charge to which he was pleading, the rights he was waiving, and the direct consequences. Well, there's no question about the consequences or the rights he gave up. The issue is, did he understand the charge to which he was pleading? And for a layperson, I believe he certainly did. He understood that he was pleading guilty to a crime that involved sexual penetration by a victim who was falling down drunk and incapable of consenting. And again, I would submit that the intelligent aspect of it is shown by the fact that he had access to the complaint. He went through the complaint with his attorney, and he told the court that he understood the charge to which he was pleading guilty. And in fact, he said that twice during the plea colloquy.
Which, of course, on the first page of the plea agreement is identified as the mental incapacity alternative prong under 1D.
That's true. I would note that the district court did turn to the defense attorney and asked her if she was going to inquire about either mental incapacity or physical helplessness, and it was Mr. Mongar's attorney who chose to proceed under the mental incapacity prong. And again, I would respectfully disagree with counsel that cases such as Spaeth and Ashman strictly apply contract principles to guilty pleas. I think they analogize to them in certain circumstances, but that's when there is a promise by the prosecutor, and there was no promise here. This was an open plea to third-degree criminal sexual conduct.
Well, the promise was dismissal of other more serious charges, wasn't it?
That is true. There was a separate complaint that referenced the same incident that I believe had charged first and second degree criminal sexual conduct. And this complaint was filed shortly before the plea, obviously contemplating the plea agreement, and so the other more serious charges were dismissed.
Do you think that post-Khalil, this would be an accurate plea as to the mental incapacitation?
No one's making any claim that there was anything administered to the victim involuntarily. I mean, she became intoxicated herself. So there's no basis under the current interpretation of Khalil that is satisfied. But I am saying that the physical helpless definition is met here, and his factual basis under existing case law certainly does support that. And I would point out, as the court already did, that he did not plead guilty to a more serious offense than he could have been convicted at trial. This is exactly the same offense with the exact same statute and with the exact same penalty. My worry is that counsel's position is almost requiring us to repeat verbatim to a defendant during a guilty plea the exact words of the statute, which may not mean much to a defendant. That's why they have an attorney to help them with understanding terms. There are no magic words necessary for a guilty plea, and I'm worried that we are getting towards that point where we simply have to regurgitate the words of the statute to uphold a guilty plea. So for all of these reasons, I would ask the court to uphold the post-conviction court's ruling and affirm the conviction. And if there are no other questions, I will conclude.
It appears not. Thank you. Mr. Axelson, you'll have a rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honors. I just want to say that before you would ever get to the factual basis, you have to the first step of this is deciding whether this is a breach. I think it is pretty clear from the plea petition, even though, you know, the complaint initially charged 1D, the plea petition is clear. We're only talking about mental incapacitation. On page 14 of the plea discussion, the judge brings up both. Defense attorney says it's only mental incapacitation. At that point, the state would have had the opportunity to say, we're stroking with a broad brush, and we also want to cover physical helplessness. And then defense attorney, but
there was no reason to do so before Khalil, was there? I mean, the case law, as I understand it, before there didn't signify what the Supreme Court did in Khalil, that is, that it cannot be a voluntary intoxication.
they would have no reason to think that the mental incapacitation wouldn't have applied there, but we also don't have any, you know, he wants to say that the defendant wouldn't have cared. We don't know that the defendant wouldn't have cared. The defendant barely put in a factual basis in this case at all. He probably did care about whether or not she couldn't give reasoned consent versus she was unconscious altogether. So we don't know that because the state didn't say, let's also put a factual basis for physical helplessness, because at that point he would have had the opportunity in a contract to say, no, I don't agree with that. That's an offer and there would have been no acceptance. We don't have acceptance here. And Ashman does say that contract principles apply to plea agreements in criminal matters. So for him to minimize that is incorrect. The first step is deciding, is this a breach? I believe that it is based on the overwhelming evidence that he really only was pleading guilty to mental incapacitation. The second step, if you don't agree it's a breach, we still have the Detman problem of he's not knowingly, voluntarily, and intelligently pleading guilty to this other version of 1D. And then finally, if you get to the factual basis, you know, again, I think the state concedes that every case where they find this is sufficient is based on, at some point, the person is going in and out of consciousness, and we don't have that here.
But those are all jury trials.
Those are all jury trials, but we also, you know, there isn't a adequate factual basis on physical helplessness because it wasn't being considered. It wasn't something that the state was trying to elicit. They were just trying to elicit that there was her being fall down drunk would establish a factual basis and really make it impenetrable on failure to give reasoned consent, but it would have been insufficient on the next step of physical helplessness. We're just asking you to follow the specific terms of the plea agreement here. This is not a case that is going to come up again. There are no future ramifications for other cases. You're just applying Supreme Court case law to this case, and we ask that you reverse his conviction, allow him to withdraw his guilty plea, and start this case over so the parties can come to an agreement either on a future plea agreement or go to trial on this case. Thank you.
Yeah, I think there may be a couple more cases like this that fall between the Khalil decision and the time of the plea.
I mean, I would agree that there probably are some cases. It probably was surprising to the private attorney who filed the post-conviction.
Or perhaps there are cases where the defendant does not want to withdraw his or her plea.
Yes, there probably are, you know, and that would be a situation here where the judge could have said, do you want the opportunity to withdraw your guilty plea, or would you like to enter a factual basis on physical helplessness? And that may have been an easy way to do this. But the way the judge did this was not correct. The judge's order is filled with inaccuracies. I couldn't even make hide or hair about the judicial estoppel argument that's in there. I mean, none of it really makes any sense. It's not following established case law, and that's all we're asking you to do today.
Well, the judge was just asked to vacate the conviction.
It's probably a mistake on the private attorney's part, that was also an incorrect
that
statement
happens.
Of the law. Yes. Unless the court has additional questions, I don't have anything further.
There are none. Thank you to both counsel. The argument.